bit of a quiz for you while you're doing that. I'm going to mention a few places, and I want to see how you identify these places. I hope this works. It depends upon your ability to, play millionaire or something like that, as we did yesterday morning at the church council meeting. I'm going to use some places. I think these are easy. I'll say the place, and you tell me what comes to your mind. You ready? Wall Street. Okay, good. You're off to a good start. Madison Avenue. Okay, I think I heard some right answers in there. Las Vegas. Okay, all right. Sodom and Gomorrah. Jerusalem. Okay, I hear chattering. Babylon. No, okay, all right. We flattened out there, so we're at the right place. I did that with you because Babylon is, it's massive in its importance in the Bible. It's all over the place. And Babylon is used in the Bible as representative of something. So there is something that should come to your biblically informed mind when Babylon is mentioned. So I'm here to help you. And we will do that. So that we are now on the threshold of Revelation 17 and 18. And we're going to take a couple of weeks getting into these two chapters because there is some background work that's necessary. And here's what we will do. I'm going to read Revelation 17, 1 through 6. That's the vision of Babylon. Babylon the Great. The harlot. But we're not going to work with the text in Revelation 17. We're going to go to the headwaters of teaching on Babylon. And where might that be, Bible students? Yes, Genesis chapter 11. So that's where we will go, and we will we'll take a little time for some discussion, some questions. So let's do that. Now follow with me. I'm going to read Revelation 17, 1 through 6. You have it? Here we go. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." Obviously, this passage is heavy with symbolism. And the interpretation is given in verses 7 to 18. So I'm not going to try to unpack all of these statements in verses 1 to 5. But you will want to underscore this judgment of the great harlot. That is a key statement, which is going to be our directional signal for the following two chapters in Revelation. See, Revelation gives two entire chapters to the fall of Babylon. "With whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Perhaps you have enough background on this statement that you recognize that this titled sentence here is saying essentially that here in this Babylon the Great, there is a vast system of idolatry. Now, that's a big step toward understanding what Babylon represents in the Scriptures. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. Now, I'm going to take you to Genesis, but I want to make two statements. Let's get these together, and then we'll go to Genesis chapter 11. First, Revelation 17 and 18 expand the seventh bowl. We gave our attention to that last Sunday evening. Do you get a mental picture? Do you have a little slide that comes into your mind by now in understanding Revelation? In many ways, Revelation is not hard to understand. That card's overplayed. Just takes a lot of work. We have seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls. And these seven bowls of wrath come at the conclusion of the tribulation. It's the pouring out of wrath, God's wrath, upon the earth. Revelation 17 and 18 actually continue that seventh bowl. And what they do, these two chapters do, is to describe this judgment of God upon Babylon, the great harlot. This judgment is the judgment of God on all false religion. Now, I hope to demonstrate that to you as we go through into go to Genesis 11. We will next Sunday evening go into, 2 weeks from tonight, we'll go to Zechariah. And this will, I think, increasingly become clear to you. It's what I've said here. This judgment of God, this is the judgment of God on all false religion. Let me say a second thing. This vision, this false religious system revealed in this vision, is called Babylon the Great. She's called a prostitute. Verse 5. Now, why is this street language used? This street language is used to convey spiritual realities. It's effective. Get your attention. The prostitute is, my terms, ecumenical religion. It is her sexual promiscuity is an act of spiritual betrayal. She, this Babylon the Great, she has abandoned the true God for false gods. You see the idea of betrayal, harlotry, chasing other gods? Now, this is the theme that you come on this theme in the Old Testament prophets, don't you? Where Israel is called a harlot when she's disobedient, when she's committed, when she's broken covenant with God, and she's called a prostitute. The pursuit of idols was an act of spiritual prostitution. What Old Testament book is built around this theme? And the prophet was a player in this very, it was an acted out symbol. And who was that prophet? And what book is that? Yeah, Hosea. Hosea gave his life to the bitter pain of having his wife betray him and chase after other lovers. She sleeps around. And what is this portraying? God was saying through this bitter experience of Hosea, his servant, that Israel, here you are. This is what you have done. And so this idea is not one that is foreign to us. We understand how God portrays unfaithfulness to Him, treachery, betrayal, and going after other gods. With that in mind, now I want us to go to Genesis in the 11th chapter. Let's go there, please. I'm going to have to take you there by way. I'm going to read two little blocks of Scripture. I'm going to read Genesis in chapter 10 and verses 6 through 11. And then we're going to Genesis 11 and we're going to go through verses 1 to 9. And what I would like to do is to take you through the Genesis 11, 1 to 9 passage, walk you through it. And then I'm going to give you a summation of it in terms of its theological import, what it's saying to us about Babylon. And what we, when we get through, I want you to have a handle on the significance of Babylon in the Bible. That when Babylon comes to mind, what should you think of? As quickly as you think of Las Vegas, when you think of Las Vegas, you think of gambling. When you think of Wall Street, you think of finances. When you think of Babylon, what should you think of? All right, let's see where we'll get to that. Now I'm going to read chapter 10, verse 6, beginning at verse 6. And the sons of Ham were Cush, Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Here we're getting the genealogy of Ham and his family. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. And the sons of Cush were Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Rama, and Sabekta. And the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. There is a play on words here, and this word Nimrod, the Hebrew word is marav, meaning to rebel. And Nimrod is brought up in the narrative here because he became an ancient prototype for all big-named rebels. A rebel against God. I think this is the idea. I don't think he's mentioned here because he was some sort of great deer hunter that God is saying to us, I think, more than that. Like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, in the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech, Akkad and Calne in the land of Shinar. From that land, he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ir in Kala and resting between Nineveh and Kala, that is, the great city. I think it's very significant here that Nimrod and Babylon is associated also with Assyria. I think what we're getting is a movement in this massive idea of how Babylon becomes representative of, should I give it away here right at this point? No, I won't. Let's go forward to, hold that. Let's go now into Genesis chapter 11, and I'm going to walk you through it, and let's recreate the scene with this text. This is approximately 100 years after the flood. And we pick up the narrative in verse 1, and the whole earth was of one language and one speech. All had the same vocabulary. And what's taking place here contextually is that here is an explanation of something that's preceded chapter 11, namely the distribution of the nations is recorded in verse 10, or chapter 10. And here we're going to get an explanation of what contributed to that. And the whole earth was of one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. And they settled there. They dwelt there. So we give a picture of a massive migration from the foothills of Mount Ararat, where the ark came to rest. And these peoples moved in mass down into that, what we know as that part of that Fertile Crescent, that area around the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. So they moved into that area, and then we find something happening by way of construction and building. Special attention now is given in this narrative to the fact that they build something, and this building is an above-average structure. Let's see it. And they said to one another, come, or the imperative is used here, come on, come on, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. The word slime here is the word kemar, the Hebrew word kemar. It's from the verb kamar, meaning to boil up. The Greek word, the Septuagint, translates this word asphaltos. Yes, this is the word asphalt, you hear it. And what they were doing is taking this bitumen, this asphalt, and they were using it as mortar. Mortar, a cement substitute, sealing the joints and constructing this, as we'll see, this tower that they're going to build. So here we have on the record then the first urban project after the flood. What kind of project? And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Literally that reads, whose top is with heaven. Now give these people credit. They are not attempting to try to create some earth bridge to outer space to get up into the stars. That's not what they were doing. They were not trying to poke a hole in the stratosphere. What they were doing was constructing a ziggurat. And this is a layered, stepped pyramid. And at the top of this pyramid would have been some replication would have been a temple area at the top, and it would have been an attempt to replicate some heavenly realities, at least as they perceive them to be. In other words, it was the occasion for an idolatrous system to be carried out and to create some portray here the continuity between earth and heaven. Here's earth, the slab upon which this ziggurat was built with the stepped effect, and at the top in this room would have been some, we don't know what all was in it. Some suggest, you know, enameled and colored and blue and perhaps with the signs of the zodiac. We don't know. But that's what they were attempting to do. And they say, the text says, they will build a tower. Actually, the word here, tower, is the Hebrew word is migdal, M-I-G-D-A-L, is a temple tower, is the idea. I think this is a symbol of a defiance of God. Well, it says a tower whose top may reach into heaven, and let us make a name. A name, let me pause. I'm going to come back to this and give it some further elaboration, but I want to take this word name, Shem, the name Shem, name. What they want to do is establish a reputation. There is something going on here that's a reflection of what's in their heart, and it's not pretty. And it's massive pride. In defiance of God, who's told them to scatter, they don't want to scatter. They want to collectivize their existence, come together, and build this empire centered upon this act of worship in this ziggurat at this temple tower. So that is their desire, to make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So here's this defiance of God. God told them to go out to populate the face of the earth, and this is an act contrary to it. And Jehovah, the Lord, came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. Now understand something about the language here. When God directed Moses to give this account, God chose this language
for the sake of portraying the littleness of man and the bigness of God in humorous language. This is humorous, in case you didn't know. I'm seeing a lot of straight faces. This is humor here. I mean, here, get the picture. I mean, is it that an infinite, omnipotent, omniscient God actually has to suit up and make a journey and just do a little on-site inspection here of this construction project? Obviously not. But God is not embarrassed to present himself in this way. This is called this is anthropomorphic language. God presents himself this way, and he's big enough to do it. But there are people who've tried to shrink God based upon anthropomorphic language. And here is the picture of puny man building this dinky little tower in this pitiful little city. And the picture is of God is, well, let us, I think, allowing for the Godhead here in the language that has to be brought in by further development in the progress of doctrine, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit, I think it allows for that. But he said, let's go see what they're doing down there. So in the minds of man, building this tower in the city was something in which to glory. It would be as if, you know, the way we have gloried in our space program and space exploration. So God, that looks like paper airplanes. That kind of thing. But I'm trying to get you to see the humor, the point of it all. And don't let this kind of language frighten you. Like God has some sort of senior moment and he's got to go in and see what's going on, check it out. It's to put man in his place. Man is little, God is big. So God comes for an on-site inspection. And he came down, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men builded. Or at least they had built to that point. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, same language. This is what they begin to do. And now nothing will be withholden from them. That is, nothing that they desire to do will they desist. Merely the beginning of what they do. And what God is going to do is, for their own protection, is going to institute a very important principle in his plan, and his call. Well, I'll tell you that in a minute. Let's go on with the text. So, which they will purpose to do. Come, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. As I said, they think they're doing a big thing, but actually it's a rather puny thing. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore the name of it was the name of it called Babel, meaning confusion. Because the Lord there, Balal, confused the language and the language of all the earth, and from thence the Lord scattered them abroad upon the face of all the earth. So here they were, caught up in this massive construction project, and I really could use some help here if I had some different languages. If I could say, could you please bring me some more bricks? If I could have someone say that in Spanish, if I could have someone say that in French, if I could have someone say that in German, do I have enough linguists to do this? I don't. Okay. Anya's not here. I would get it in Russian, I guess. But, all right. So, the idea, though, is that there they are, now speaking to one another in different languages, And coming with a language is a different way of looking at the world. It, you know, a lot goes with language. I can't take that sidebar and go to the issue of what happened here as the language has changed. I want to come back to this passage, and I want us to look at these four theological implications as they bear on the issue of Babylon. All right, let's proceed with them. There are these. One, the history of Babylon begins in Genesis 11. The consequence we see in Revelation 17 and 18 goes back to this occasion in Genesis 11. The history of Babylon begins in Genesis 11, and it reveals the spiritual nature of the great harlot, Babylon the Great. If you want to know what's going on, understand that what the John in the 5th chapter in the 19th verse, 1 John 5:19, we know that we are of God and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. I'm saying to you that what Babylon becomes representative of is that world system that lies in the lap of the evil one. Babylon is used in the Bible for the world system that exists under the rule of Satan. The world in collectivized defiance against God. That's what Babylon represents. It's presented this way. Here is this fist in God's face with this determination to live in a form of internationalism in contrast to scattering. And as I will show you, that judgment that God brought was actually a preservative judgment. It was a mercy judgment in terms of nationalism. So the world seeks unity. Globalism seems to be the continuing, it is the continuing attempt of the world. It's really picked up steam in the last half of the, well, it did in the last half of the last century. Globalism. By globalism, I mean the attempt, the desire to bring all the nations under one ruling authority. The desire of many world leaders for peace and unity. I think that this passage, this story of Babylon, and what we find coming out of it through the rest of the Old Testament, in the book of Isaiah and Zechariah, and then Revelation 17 and 18, points to this movement of the world, in the world, by Satan to try to consolidate his kingdom and make it enduring. That's what's going on. This is the human counterpart to the spiritual counterpart in the kingdom of darkness. That attempt of Satan through the use of human beings to try to create an enduring kingdom. Now, Satan can't do it because you know what kind of people he's got to work with. He's actually, the very thing for which Satan fell is prohibits him from bringing about this globalism. Namely, he has to try to organize sinful hearts, rebel hearts. Try to get rebel hearts to come together in peace and unity. This, I'm really giving you a scan of the whole history of the human race here. But I want you to see this picture of globalism. I want to pause here and say something. It came up. It's been hot in the news, and I was interested in the interview the other night, and I saw that this understanding of globalism and how it has affected the way many Christians think and keeps many Christians, and I think in some cases, some justifiably suspicious of globalism. And you are aware of, I don't want to start swerving all over the road on this thing doctrinally, but you know that there are movements, militia movements, that are in this nation that they have just a little pinch of biblical information, and you fold that in with rabid nationalism, and mix in further in the mix, put in a white supremacy mentality, and what do you get? You get some vicious kinds of evil. I'll tell you what you get. That's what you get. You get that master race mentality. Now that's nationalism that goes to seed. But let me come back to what I was want to stay with, and that is how many Christians and those who've been influenced by Christianity are highly suspicious of globalism. Are we not? United Nations, or the old League of Nations, now the United Nations, sending troops in under a United Nations banner, flag, as we are in Kosovo now, Bosnia, places that are like this around the world. But this thing has, I think, gone in other directions which have hurt Christians, and that's what I want to get to. Bob Jones University has come kind of center stage in the last month or so, since the New Hampshire primary. Well, no, it was South Carolina. And the South Carolina primary, and George W. Bush spoke in to the students at Bob Jones University. Well, this has created a firestorm. People who knew nothing about Bob Jones University now know a good deal about it. Not always correctly represented, but they know much more than they did. And Bob Jones the third was on Larry King Live Friday night. I'd heard it was going to be on, and I made it a point to get Timothy and to get Jamie in so we could, if we'd eaten out and said, we've got to get home. I want to see this interview with Larry King live with Bob Jones III. So I've met, spoken with Bob Jones Sr. I've met and spoken with Bob Jones Jr., both who are now with the Lord. And I met and had conversed with Bob Jones III. And I'm not going into my historical experiences with the school and so forth. My point is this, that I noticed that in the discussion, in the questions that were coming up regarding Bob Jones University's position on interracial dating, that the foundation for that rule, the basis for that rule, as Bob Jones III even admitted, that he couldn't go to a text. But what point was he arguing that had been used to not allow interracial dating and marriage and so forth? What was it? Globalism. It was globalism. The idea that there was somehow that to allow it would be interracial marriage, dating, then marriage, would contribute to the breaking down of divinely ordained barriers, fences, so as to keep these races separate and until the Lord comes. All I want to say on that is this, that you've gone down a wrong road with that. That is not what this passage provides for us as a prototype. Babylon as a prototype has nothing to do with interracial dating and marriage. Now, I'm not here trying to ding on Bob Jones University. I think for the most part they've been misrepresented, viciously so. They have been, and I don't take any comfort, though I have not, and I don't mind going public with this statement, that yes, it was a personal disappointment in some early years of mine in ministry that many that the school represented, Bob Jones University, did not help in leading the way in confronting racism, segregation in the South. And we were all complicit in that. And I was to some extent myself. I mean, we were passive. And I really didn't wake up until I was 20-ish, 19, 20. And like many in the South, I was a co-conspirator by just being passive in the face of evil. And folks, when there is evil, like there was, in excluding blacks from universities, Christian schools in the South, that was wrong. And you know, I've gone off into this, so I got to finish it. All right, I get back. That And I'm not saying Bob Jones is the only one that failed here. We all did. So please don't, I'm not singling them out and try to polish my apple here in some way. That Jesse Jackson's mother listened faithfully to Bob Jones Sr. on radio, WMUU. I used to hear Dr. Bob regularly on radio. Jesse Jackson's mother listened to that. But do you know what? Jesse Jackson couldn't go to Bob Jones University. He couldn't go to Columbia Bible College. He couldn't go to Dallas Theological Seminary. You know where he went? He went to Chicago Divinity School. The same was true of Martin Luther King. That schools which could have provided a strong biblical moorings in the South at that time, white seminaries, Bible schools, they were not open to blacks. Where did Martin Luther King Jr. go? Went to, was it Boston? Was it Boston? Not Boston College. It was the seminary there in the Boston area, liberal. So, if you wonder where that liberal twist comes from that you see in the civil rights movement, that's it. And so, I remind Christians of this when they want to get on their high horse about the civil rights and the liberalism that you hear, and it's but I'm telling you, it's a consequence because we in the South, Christians in the South, were not courageous enough to challenge the culture. We weren't courageous enough because it may have meant your church would have been burned down. You could have been killed. Believe me, you could have been. There were KKK rallies. There were men on the street I grew up in East Point, who were known KKKers. And I remember passing a meeting, the old Huddle House on Campbellton Road in the 50s. One night we were cruising around as teenagers. The KKKers were out with their demonstrations. And on Stone Mountain every year, they burned crosses and had a massive gathering. And the news reported it without criticism. Not like it would be criticized today. I'm saying there was complicity. And you know what? You didn't hear a peep out of any churches. And that was a raw, vicious evil. One effect of that on me to this moment is to say, oh Lord, what evil is it that I'm... Where am I looking the other way at now? All right, that took... All right, back to off the point. Globalism. Let's move through these other issues. The motive for building a city and a tower was pride and rebellion against the authority of the omnipotent sovereign God. That, I think, is the driving motive, and this passage is giving to us this picture of these who are seeking strength from unity. But their act was actually one of rebellion against the stated will of God when they said, let us build, and they should have been scattering. You know, essentially, all false religion is really some modification of this original Babel project. Namely, it is to reach God on one's own terms. That's the stuff of idolatry. And that's what Babel represents. It was also, and I want to take those, there are about five of those statements there in verse 5, let us build. And then in the second place, a city. What's going on here? This was an act of governmental rebellion against God. And in the third place, they said we want a tower. This was an act of spiritual rebellion against God. This stepped pyramid, as I've said earlier, was a proclaimed continuity between earth and heaven, with heaven. In the fourth place, they said, let us make a name. This was flagrant manifestation of pride. The tower was designed to be a monument to their energy, to their daring, to their genius, to their resources. And fifthly, said that lest we be scattered. This was an attempt at collectivism to deal with their insecurities. An attempt at collectivism to deal with their insecurities. This is contrary to the way in which God's people think and live in this world. It is the name of the Lord that's a strong tower. He alone can deal with our insecurities. And believe me, we're all a walking package of insecurities. But only God can settle those insecurities. And I'm saying to you that on an international basis, mankind is filled with insecurity. That's why globalism is increasingly attractive to the human race. In the face of what could just be catastrophic things. Pollution, nuclear war, that was the driving thing, wasn't it, for decades. Those who've grown up, born after the so-called Cold War, many of us remember that the driving, the fear was a nuclear holocaust. Just would destroy us all. And so we've got to get together. We've got to pull together. And so this collectivism and this contrasting with the trust of God's people in the name of the Lord for their securities. Thirdly, God judged the first attempt at internationalism and one world government. God judged it. This judgment was an act of mercy. How? It helped to preserve human freedom because God at this point institutionalized what? Nationalism. Nationalism for the purpose of preserving personal liberty in a sinful world. Now, I'm not saying nationalism in and of itself is a moral virtue. It can certainly be taken and turned into an evil. What happens with a nationalism when it turns into imperialism, doesn't it? I've never really understood fully this whole business of right and left politically. People are identified, you're an extreme rightist and they associate you with fascism. And on the left is communism. And I've always thought, well, aren't both of these totalitarian? What's really the difference? Don't they kind of meet? I mean, they're so far out that way that they've actually met. They're just different versions of the same thing. And that is tyranny. And what was the Soviet Union in its heyday? But imperialism. And so I'm saying that God placed nationalism, not a sanctioning of the kind of the Russia, of the Soviet Union, or of Germany, Nazi Germany, but where nations feel fiercely independent of one another. That's a preservative. That's the good as it's going to get in this world. Can't soar off into those directions as to how the euro and what's happening in the common market, and we'll get that later on. So here is what happens then with this judgment of internationalism and one world government. Nationalism does provide a preventative for collectivism and rapid degeneration. The more consolidation there is, the more unification without God, the faster the degeneration. And the greater the loss of freedom, the greater the threat to freedom. All right, finally, I must conclude. The Tower of Babel then became the beginning of man's attempt to build an enduring kingdom on earth without God. Babylon became the representative of all false religion and satanic internationalism. Babylon then, in conclusion, serves as a prototype of the Babylon of the future. This Babylon in Genesis 11 is a prototype of the Babylon that we confront, that we find in Revelation 17 and 18. Because of the evil character of the original Babylon provides for us this connection. This logo, if you will. Babylon becomes something of a logo for evil. Evil in internationalism. The Babylon of Revelation 17 and 18 is organized religion at the end time. It will appear to be joined to the true God, but actually it would be resistant to and an abandonment of the true God. This is a warning. The warning of the ever-present nature and the danger of idolatry and internationalism and globalism with the attempt to bring down national boundaries, nationalism, and create a unification of the nations under one banner that plays into the hands of the evil one. So, do we understand then, we've come full circle, the relationship then of Babylon to that which it symbolizes? And what is it? That Babylon in the Bible is symbolic of all collective rebellion and defiance against God. You ready? Las Vegas. Gambling. Wall Street. Sodom and Gomorrah. Raw, unadorned evil. Vicious evil. Babylon. Good. You got the lesson. Lord, work this truth into our hearts for greater wisdom as we work our way along in this world. God, to be alert to the idols that lurk in the corners of our heart. As we seek to go to those things that allure us, that would provide, that would present to us some satisfaction or promise to us satisfaction of a desire. And that desire can only be fulfilled in you. So God, grant us now that kind of biblical tough-mindedness, Lord, that where we could be protected from error, to see that it is better to be divided by truth than to be united in error. So we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.